Bev, Bev, where'd you buy that coffee, Bev?
Ryan, I bought this coffee at the grocery store, Ryan.
Bev, you're so stupid, Bev. You're so stupid. Why did you do that, Bev? You're so stupid.
That is pretty stupid. Especially since every coffee lover knows that the secret to making the best cup of coffee is freshly roasted beans. But the coffee you get at the grocery store is sometimes roasted months before it gets to you. Which is why it's time to switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug is a fantastic service that delivers fresh, high-quality coffee right to your door. Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans sourced through direct and fairly traded methods, and they have many blends to choose from to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. You can order it as you need it or take advantage of their autopilot set-it-and-forget-it delivery system so that you never run out of coffee again. But the best part is that Sparkplug doesn't roast your coffee until you order it and then has it at your door within a week. No more stale grocery store coffee for you. It's time for your favorite cup to start coming from your own kitchen, so plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Bev, that sounds like a pretty good deal, Bev.
Ryan, it is, Ryan.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey all, and most gracious thank yous for lending an ear to the Top 120 Project. We're down to the final four in our analysis of the 123 titles on the 1998 and 2007 lists of AFI Greats. You must be among the zillions of people who have seen this blockbuster, but careful if you haven't, because we're going to spoil it. I am the sewer rat from steerage, Ryan Ellis, with my first-class wife, Bev.
That's me, Ryan.
Bev.
Ryan.
Bev.
Ryan.
Half the podcast should be our names, just like half the screenplay in Titanic were their names. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for Titanic. It's unusual for an AFI movie to also rank on both the Top 100 Passions and the Top 100 Thrills, but six movies did. Name them.
So, it started with King Kong.
Correct.
Casablanca was next. Double Indemnity.
One of my favorites.
Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
Bonnie and Clyde. And, of course, Titanic.
Six for six. What was the bonus, the non-AFI film, that actually was on the Thrills and Passions list?
It was Notorious. You're welcome.
Hitchcock's classic film that Bev has not yet seen. We will watch one of these days and maybe review it next year when we continue on with the post-Top 100 project. All right, you got them all. Well done.
Yes.
Her thumbs are up. Okay, the Top 100 Project's 120th film, Titanic, did not qualify for AFI's 1998 Top 100, but then it sailed into 83rd spot in 2007, sandwiched between Sunrise and Easy Rider. After a series of premieres in November and early December, Fox and Paramount teamed up to release Titanic in America on December 19, 1997. Reviews were not rapturous across the board, but it became the biggest moneymaker of all time and remained that way for 12 years. Not adjusted for inflation, just flat out made the most money. Well, Bev, 20 people that have ever lived have not seen Titanic, but describe it for those 20 people right now.
Two pretty people meet on the Atlantic Ocean and fall in love. Hundreds of people die, but pshaw, it's all about Jack and Rose.
Jack!
Rose!
Jack!
Rose!
Jack!
Rose!
Or, in a nutshell, the boat sinks.
I remember when this movie was in production and everybody expected it to be a flop, and Cameron had this reputation of being this arrogant, maniacal lunatic that had spent hundreds of millions of dollars making a movie that everyone knew the ending to, you know?
We've covered a few movies the last few months where the filmmakers did not know they had a hit on their hands, though. I don't know that Cameron, or at least the studio, had any idea this movie would be even just a break-even.
I mean, you never know.
True, but Spielberg didn't know that Schindler's List was going to be a success, let alone a blockbuster. Saving Private Ryan, he thought the same thing about that movie. That was the biggest hit of 1998. And according to recent interviews by Robert Rodriguez talking about Pulp Fiction with Tarantino, and they're, of course, close friends, Tarantino didn't know that Pulp Fiction was going to succeed, according to his own friend. So a lot of filmmakers have made big hits, and they didn't realize what they had. Lucas with Star Wars didn't know he had a big hit. He ran away. I don't want to be around. This opens, and then it's this monster success.
Can you imagine the horrible anxiety of being a filmmaker and having big budget Hollywood film open and just waiting for those numbers to roll in and see whether people go to see it or not?
So much is tied into that because your future is tied into that for one thing. You may not get to make another movie if it flops.
And your pride and just wanting people to see your work.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, the numbers on Titanic, and there are plenty of them. Rotten Tomatoes critics, 88% like the movie, 157 fresh, 21 rotten. But 69% of audiences, those are Forrest Gump splits right there. Janet Maslin, critic with the, I think, New York Times, compared this to Gone with the Wind. Titanic is fifth all-time on the Box Office Mojo Adjusted for Inflation list. And what is number one all-time on the Adjusted for Inflation list?
Oh, Gone with the Wind,
which we just
baby.
Said. And Star Wars, we just said. They're number one and number two. Of course, Titanic was first at the 1997 U.S. box office, and for about 4 months straight into 1998, Men in Black was number two in 1997, but way behind Titanic. First trivia question, what broke that streak by Titanic at number one in the spring of 98?
Was it Private Ryan?
Nope.
No, because that was much later in the year.
William Hurt movie, Gary Oldman's also in it, based on an old TV show, Lost in Space.
Come on, really?
Well, something had to end that run.
Ay, ay, ay.
You mentioned James Cameron already, the director of this picture. He'd been making hit after hit, or at least movies that succeeded for the most part. Maybe not The Abyss. By his standards, that was a flop. The Terminator didn't have a big budget. It did pretty well, and certainly the critics have looked at it fondly ever since. Alien succeeded, T2 certainly succeeded, True Lies succeeded. He tried to make Spider-Man around this same time frame, actually, but they didn't have the technology to do the special effects for that. And he got obsessed with deep sea diving right around the same time he started making this movie. And he's been quoted as saying he just wanted to dive down to Titanic. And the excuse was, well, let's just make a movie. We'll call it Romeo and Juliet on a Boat. So what did you think of Romeo and Juliet on a Boat?
If only the listeners could see my grimace. I'm a Titanic hater. I complain about Spielberg spelling everything out too much, but James Cameron makes Spielberg look vague and impenetrable.
Let me hit your head for you.
Right.
I'll hit you on the head the way he hits us on that. Does that hurt yet? Okay.
His characters are one-dimensional fantasy fulfillment. There's only one thing in the world Cameron thinks is stupider than the average first-class luxury liner passenger, and that is the movie going public. Sorry if you like it, but I'm gonna kind of dump all over this movie.
Well, it is a triumph of design, mm-hmm. effects, and scope, but with a profoundly idiotic screenplay.
Yes.
Even more so when we've been watching so many great screenplays in the 90s, with Pulp Fiction topping that list. But even Forrest Gump's screenplay is pretty good. Shawshank Redemption's was good. Back to the Future, we covered for the Not 100 Project, one of the great screenplays of all time. And now this.
So it hurts me to admit this, but the screenplay isn't all bad. The dialogue is terrible. But
that's the worst part.
It is absolutely. And the characters are really poorly drawn. But in many aspects, it's a fantastic screenplay. I mean, the story of Titanic, at least the stuff that takes place in 1912, it has a decent pace. It has good direction. And he had the smarts to introduce a lot of elements early that become relevant later, like Rose loves art, Jack is an artist, and he draws Rose, and that drawing becomes the object that gets Rose back into the Atlantic 84 years later.
Yeah, the plot hinges on disintegrating softcore porn.
Yeah, like everything else falls apart but that drawing. Anyways, but it does have like an elegance to it, and just the sheer shameless shallowness of its characters and that god-awful dialogue and the way he just spells everything out for us like we're children.
All they were talking about in the boat is the boat.
Oh, it's unbearable.
And being rich. Or being poor.
But that must be what people like. People must like their stories being fed to them like pablum, because Titanic spent almost a year in theaters, like you said, and it was a full-blown phenomenon. Perhaps it's not the script that's stupid. But James Cameron, who is brilliant at getting the average person, not the average movie snob like you and I, and hopefully our listeners and not people who hate our guts right now, but to the average moviegoer to get them into the theater and to come back for more. He also had the brains to appeal to young women, teenage girls, who at the time were not really a demographic that people went after. Now Hollywood's totally onto it, and they've got the Twilight and the Hunger Games and all kinds of stuff meant strictly for this demo. But when Titanic came out, you had a lot of people that had money in their pockets and not a lot of things being made to appeal to them.
And looking for repeat business from these people. Mm-hmm. Back in 97 into 98, DVD was just coming into play. Certainly no Blu-ray, definitely no downloading. And VHS was one thing, but people said, you gotta see Titanic on the big screen, which I never did. I think you did, right?
Twice. I got dragged to this movie 2 times.
How did you feel about it then?
Okay, so the first time I saw it, I was already at 19 years old. Even though I wasn't a key demographic, I was already well into my journey as a shameless film snob. So I hated it just for all the reasons that you should hate Titanic. But also, it just happens that the first time I saw it, it was the day after I had broken up with this really crappy boyfriend who was really controlling. The whole romance between Jack and Rose just didn't come anywhere near penetrating my heart. I didn't care. I wanted to like stand up in the theater and yell, "Stay on the boat with your mother, Rose! Leave Jack behind!"
Well, Cal is the controlling boyfriend in this story. Yeah. You must have hated him pretty bad.
Oh, sure, except that he's a ridiculous mustache-twisting villain and doesn't resemble any humans, let alone an actual behavior of an abusive husband.
I almost took a note, and then I had to stop myself, to say that Cal isn't being quite that way. When Jack saves Rose from diving into the water, which is such a stupid thing, too. I was trapped. I had to get away. It's so bad. Okay, I probably shouldn't judge somebody who's suicidal because we've all been down and okay.
Especially fine. Teenage girls.
Well, yeah, I'm sure a lot of girls relate to that part as much as anything. But once that happens, he isn't as condescending to Jack as I'd remembered when I saw the movie before, and it's been a long time since I did see this movie. And then when they all go to dinner together, he wasn't quite as bad as I thought he had been. When he's abusive towards Rose later, of course, that's hitting on the head, and then the stuff at the end, because, you know, when you've got a boat going down the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and no one's around and they're all, well, mostly, are going to die. You need guns. It's like those scenes in The Day After Tomorrow. They've already got the world going to hell. These people are just barely staying alive in these freezing conditions in New York City. And then came the wolves. You don't need wolves. You've already got great drama. You don't need a gun in Titanic. The boat's going down.
But this is probably Cameron's genius. He doesn't just rely on the actual drama that was happening. He was like, we're going to have all the drama of the Titanic. And then we're just going to have scene after scene of them running around the labyrinth of the bowels of the ship while the water's rushing at them for what feels like forever. And the great scene that I actually kind of enjoy is the scene with the key when they're trapped at the gate, mm-hmm. and the guy's trying to get them out, and then he drops the key, and then Jack at the 11th hour finally gets that door open. You know he's going to. And this is what Cameron does best. He does action amazing. This is why T2 is a great film, and Aliens is a great film, and for what it's worth, I do really enjoy the good things about The Abyss. And True Lies, too. So those scenes actually play out really fun and really good, and he's such a great action director. It's worthwhile to have those elements, and it's probably what people love about the movie, as dumb as it is.
I've said many times that The Matrix is a great story, fantastic story, one of the best we've had in a very long time, but not the best screenplay, and also some stupid dialogue that's put in the mouth of that guy Tank. You're also our father, Morpheus, that kind of stupid stuff. James Cameron's screenplays, you could say the same thing. The stories are wonderful, especially the Terminator movies, the first two, but not necessarily the screenplays themselves. They used to split up the story and screenplay Oscars. You could win one just for your story, and you could win one for the screenplay itself, and sometimes you'd combine the two. Neither The Matrix nor anything Cameron's ever written has been nominated for its script, for what that's worth, and maybe they should have been if it was just a story thing. But then you get to the action, like you said. We paused the movie right when the iceberg hits the Titanic because we wanted to take a washroom break before all that stuff happened. It was almost literally halfway through the movie at that point. So you have to slog through all those scenes of on-the-nose dialogue, lazy stereotypes.
Oh, yeah.
Poor Danny Nucci. I am a Danny Nucci. I'm so Italian. And then Tommy Ryan. I can't do an Irish accent, but that guy.
He's just looking for his lucky charms. He thinks they might be in America, so he took the Titanic over.
Are you stealing from Lindy West already?
Yes, yes. No, she called him... two leprechauns standing on each other's shoulders and wearing a trench coat. And she called Fabrizio the human representation of the Olive Garden. And she says that at some point he gave everybody unlimited breadsticks.
We'll link their review of this movie like we did with Forrest Gump a while back. It's very funny. Not quite as funny as Forrest Gump's was. But Lindy West is a funny writer, and she's great at finding the hook in these movies and mocking them to death and beating it to death, much like the movie beats all of its things to death.
Before we move on from the screenplay, I think it could have been so vastly improved had they eliminated the bookend of the whole voyage to the wreckage.
You mean Raiders of the Lost Boat?
Yes.
And then plot exposition for the next 20 minutes?
All you have is a woman narrating the story about something that happened to her. You could construct a narrative to make that plausible in minutes, but instead they use a solid half hour of setup at the beginning. And I know it's because James Cameron was obsessed with shipwrecks and with deep sea diving, and he wanted an excuse to do that. And they actually went to the real Titanic. Mm-hmm. He had to talk the studio into increasing the budget to make that possible. It's not that big of an increase to get that much more reality. And of course, it's going to make a great press item because everybody's fascinated with the Titanic. It's a fascinating story. There was a reason that people keep making movies about it over and over again, although not so much anymore because this has kind of become the definitive version.
Cameron and his people spent more time with the boat than the people that got on the boat and that's made and only voyage spent on the boat.
That's right. The movie feels almost like it's longer than the Titanic's voyage.
The movie cost more than it cost to build the actual Titanic, even adjusted for inflation.
Oh my god, what? Imagine all the amazing headline fodder had that movie bombed. Every movie reviewer writing trite puns. The Titanic sinks.
Well, that's what they expected to write because it was the same with Apocalypse Now. That's going to be a terrible movie. And it was actually quite a big hit. Jaws will be a giant flop. One of the biggest hits of all time. It was the biggest hit of all time until Star Wars came along. No one really knew about Star Wars. Gone with the Wind, people didn't know it was going to end up being the biggest hit of all time because of the production things that people would have heard about in the press. They can't find Scarlett O'Hara and there's all these problems. They've changed directors. It's going to flop. And I've said this so many times before, but movies made on water, sometimes they do badly for sure, but they also can turn out to be mega hits that people love for years and years to come. Jaws and Titanic are Exhibit A and Exhibit B.
Yeah.
There's no point in getting off the screenplay idea because it was Mystery Science Theater in our living room for 3+ hours. When Rose sees the guy who built the boat, Victor Garber plays him. Good Canadian actor, been in a lot of good movies. And he says something like, I'm sorry, Rose, I didn't build you a better boat. But she says something to him, and I could see it in your eyes.
She says, I saw the iceberg, and I can see it in your eyes.
Right.
Which is the point where I couldn't take it.
You pounded
anymore.
The couch. Not in anger, but he slapping, I can't take it, it's so funny. But it's not supposed to be funny. Those two actors make it work as well as they do. Leo and Kate, people said it about them then, I think they've said about it in retrospect. They sell this dialogue as well as anybody probably could. Who knew how good Leo was going to be? He was still a kid, she was still very young.
He was already getting a lot of attention from What's Eating Gilbert Grape and This Boy's Life.
But he wasn't a leading player in a major Hollywood movie, though. And he didn't get to play a disabled boy like he did in Gilbert Grape. So that is shticky. A lot of actors have been great in those kinds of roles, but it's a thing you can rely on for shtick.
Yeah.
And Winslet had been in Sense and Sensibility, but she wasn't a leading player yet, and she's also playing an American, which has become commonplace. English people play Americans so well. I guess they always did. But in the last 20 or so years since this movie came out, so many major American iconic characters, like Batman, for example, have been played by English actors.
She campaigned like crazy for the part. Mm-hmm. Cameron really had to be convinced to use her. DiCaprio, he considered other people, but he definitely wanted DiCaprio.
Again, it's a who's who could have played these parts. Nicole Kidman was in the running for it. Madonna, she would have been all wrong for it. She's too old. So is Jodie Foster, as great as she is. She's too old for this role, unless you cast the guy a lot older. But then you lose the Romeo and Juliet aspect of it. Cameron Diaz, Jennifer Aniston, they have been good in movies, but they wouldn't have been right for this. And as far as Jack goes, the studio wanted Matthew McConaughey. That would have been a pretty good choice, but one of the things that works is that Leo is so small and he's so
boyish.
Cute and boyish, and that's probably why the teenage girls loved him so much. McConaughey wouldn't have had that quality. Chris O'Donnell was a bit of a star because of the Batman movies and some other things. Scent of a Woman, of course. Christian Bale auditioned. He would have been a great choice. Probably the best of all these names other than DiCaprio. And then Johnny Depp and Tom Cruise. Kind of usual suspects at this time frame. By the way, there was a Joseph Dawson on the boat, so Jay Dawson. But Jack is an invention, and he was actually a worker, I guess, in the coal room or something like that.
Yeah, he worked in the bowels of the ship.
And interestingly, Jack, the fake character, is last to board the ship, and then he's last to leave the ship.
Oh, yeah. How about that?
Thank you, Internet.
See? Nice touches in this screenplay that's not actually stupid. One of the touches they decided not to broadcast to us in the most transparent, phony dialogue over and over and over again.
Frances Fisher plays her mother, and as good as she was in her small role in Unforgiven as the lead prostitute, she's so one-note in this movie. And surely that's the way the screenplay was. She's just doing her job. And okay, she wants her daughter to kowtow to Cal because she needs money. And she says that explicitly. And she doesn't want this sewer rat from steerage to get into her daughter's life and mess it up, which is exactly what happens anyway. But there could have been some more humanity in this woman.
She's a terrible mother. She doesn't care about Rose at all. She has that one scene with the really transparent metaphor of her tightening Rose's corset as she's telling her about how, you know, the family's broke. Things you would never actually say to somebody who already knows these things. The awkward exposition matched with the obvious visual metaphor, and it's
yanking
the only
time, Winslet's breast as well. That's an achievement in itself.
And that's the only scene where you see Ruth display anything resembling compassion or emotion. But she's only doing it so she can manipulate Rose. And in every other opportunity she has to choose Rose over money or position or propriety, she never chooses her daughter. She tries to get her on the boat, but when she doesn't, oh well, she doesn't even seem sad. She's watching the ship sink. Her daughter is on it, and you never see her shed a tear. She's not one of the people who wants to go back and rescue people. She might be a sociopath. No wonder her and Cal like each other, because they're both evil. But everybody who's rich is evil if they were born rich. If you were born rich,
unless
with the exception of Rose.
Your name is Molly Brown.
Because she wasn't born rich. She's nouveau rich.
That's one thing that Hollywood has played on, and I know this is real, so it's not Hollywood making this up, but the idea that you had to earn your money. Oh, you're still just gutter trash.
They didn't even earn their money. They just struck gold on their property. Isn't that how she got rich.
No, but forget that. My point is that it's so stupid. If you inherited money from generations, that's supposed to make you better than somebody who actually worked for it. Or, okay, maybe it's that you got money by finding gold or finding oil or something like that, and you didn't really achieve that either. But if somebody worked hard at it, say a movie star was on that boat, Charlie Chaplin, for example, or if that had been 20 or 30 years later, name any movie star, Clark Gable or one of those guys, they would have been looked at the same way. You had to earn your money. So I never got that. And Hollywood's not in the wrong here. That's just the mentality people have. But then it's always been one thing I do hate about Hollywood, though. And Cameron is certainly a wealthy man. By this point, he was. And he was very, very, very wealthy coming out of this movie because he made so much money in percentages. It's always a bit galling when rich people make movies that mock rich people. Although Cameron would qualify as nouveau riche. He had to earn his money.
He treats the wealthy in this movie with nothing but pure contempt, and it's shallow, and it's unrealistic, and it's almost embarrassing how bad these people prove themselves to be over and over again. They're all stupid and snobby and mean, even to each other, but especially to people who aren't rich. That probably was another way that this appealed to the mass public, because most people are not wealthy, and if they are, they're not wealthy like the way the Philadelphia elite are wealthy. So there's that great superiority that people get to feel over the people that they probably envy.
They deserve to die.
It's just cheap fantasy fulfillment.
There are a few poetic touches in the movie, though, visually. Well, more than a few, I suppose. But one in particular involves a rich person. When it's Guggenheim, and I think it's supposed to be his son, we're going to go out like gentlemen. And then when the water comes crashing in, they see what they really committed to. Oh no, this was a mistake. But they do have that class to say, well, if the boat's going down, the women and children have to go first. There aren't enough boats left. We're going to go down this way. So there's a rich guy who's treated with some respect.
A lot of men, particularly older men and even rich men, some of them famous rich men, went down with the ship. That was the big story. That was the thing that the press really latched onto, the nobility of these wealthy men and their sacrifice of their lives to give their spots to women and children on those boats and the bravery that they expressed. That was the focus of the story for the first years after this happened. And they lambasted the guy who worked for White Line, who...
White Star Line.
White Star Line, thank you. Who actually had a mustache that he could twirl that was on one of those lifeboats.
Must go faster! Must go faster!
He was real, and he really did get off the boat, and the press lambasted him.
While the boat was going down, and this is a true fact, the Californian was nearby, but they turned the radio off for the night, so they didn't get the distress calls. Then again, if the Titanic people had been paying more attention in the first place, including those lookouts, iceberg, right ahead! These fake characters, Jack and Rose, distract them from their job until they look up, and there's the iceberg right there! But then they shouldn't have been going so fast in the first place, which that guy, as you said, made them do. Create more headlines by getting to New York even faster!
Another angle that people have taken while telling the story of the Titanic is the story of the hubris of it. People built this unsinkable ship and it made them so cocky that they sunk it in the first trip. What's the worst that could happen? Nothing, we're the best! And then they sunk the ship with their pride and stupidity. That became a part of the story as the years went on as well. And in the 90s, when Cameron is making this story, it becomes about the conflict between the rich and the poor.
A movie about hubris made with a lot of hubris. I also read that even modern boats would not have survived that iceberg attack.
Really?
So it wasn't just a boat made in 1912 that couldn't do it. Even one made 100 years later wouldn't have been able to get past that. And then the guy shows, much like we see with Bill Paxton and his people earlier on, showing us, and that's actually a pretty smart device, to show us how the water gets in one bulkhead, and that turns the boat down a little bit, and then it gets another bulkhead, and that tips it a little bit more, and so on, until it breaks it in half, and of course that's why it goes down. But if they had hit an iceberg, and at that speed, had it not been quite so big, maybe it could have survived it. But you rip such a big hole in there, then they just can't pump the water in time. You're buying, as the one guy says, is minutes. You're not buying hours. You're certainly not going to get yourself to shore. I said a minute ago that the Guggenheim thing was poetic. There are two other touches I want to mention right now, one of which I know you'll agree with.
Yes.
First one is the band. Also hit on the head a little bit too much. Those guys continue playing on, and it's been a pleasure playing, and then they all walk away, but the one guy stays, and they all come back and play again. But what else are those guys going to do anyway? They don't have a seat in the boat. They might as well do what they always do. And as the one guy even says, they ignore us at dinner. They're going to ignore us now. We might as well do what we can. The touch I know you like, though, the little old couple as the water rushes in beneath them and is obviously about to swallow them up and drown
them. She's scared and he's comforting her visually without any dialogue and with very few details. It encapsulates an entire story in the most beautiful and heartbreaking way. And I will say that I've seen this movie a few times. I never cry when Jack dies, but I always get misty when I just see that one single shot. And then it moves on and I recover. But that shot, and then even sometimes I think about it, it can make me emotional.
Well, much like Guggenheim, they're going out their way. No one wants to have to die like this, and it would have happened pretty quickly. It wasn't like they had hours to think about it. How are you going to go? Am I going to get on one of those boats? Am I going to stand here on the deck? Or am I going to lay there with my loved one and hold them close and say, well, at least we get to go together, as terrible as it is to have to go at all. There may not be poetry in this, but there are some legitimate funny lines. Three of them, I would say. All belong to DiCaprio when the boat is sinking. So I'll wait right here then, while he's handcuffed to the boat in that stateroom. And then when he gets Rose to practice with the axe, she misses badly on her second try. That's enough practice! And he has one other funny line, I forget at the moment. But that's one thing about this movie that I think is really lacking, too, is they're so earnest. And, okay, they're kids, they're young, they're Romeo and Juliet. What do they know? They're going to be earnest. But there's really no comic relief, and how would you really have any? Maybe Fabrizio and Tommy are supposed to be comic relief, but I don't know about that.
We the do boat see is that... a sink, and
he might as well have said things like that, yeah. Maybe the dance where we see that only the poor can have fun, and Rose smokes a cigarette, drinks beer, and stands on her tiptoes.
The rich are just so stuffy and boring and awful, and then they're having the best party ever down in the bowels of the ship.
And in case you missed it, they do go back to show Cal and the other guys sitting in that expensive room smoking cigars and talking about business where it's deadly quiet other than their conversation. There are times I'd love to be in that noisy party room, and there are many more times I'd love to be in the quiet room just talking to people, actually. So mock that all you want to, but I think you agree with me that the quiet rooms can be fun, too.
They also cut out the scenes where some of those drunk guys in steerage went back to their cabins and beat up their wives.
Especially the Irish guys. Ooh, stereotype. Oh. Well, that's what this movie would have said if they actually had a scene like that. Of course, it would have to be, right? An Irish guy's got to do that kind of stuff.
You did kind of hit a point there with the earnestness, and that could have been an additional appeal to this movie. It was the 90s. Everything was cynical. Everything was sarcastic. To have something come out that didn't have one shred of cynicism in it was probably also refreshing to the movie-going public.
Forrest Gump has some cynicism in the form of Lieutenant Dan, mostly, but that may be a reason why that movie succeeded, too.
Yeah, that's a good point. People like positive movies.
And those two are the rare romances we've had in quite a long time. We've had romantic scenes. Dances with Wolves has a romantic angle, but it's not about that. Forrest Gump isn't just about Forrest and Jenny. This movie is just about Jack and Rose's romance, like you said in the description at the beginning. Man, to hell with all those other people. It's all about this romance, including the two lookouts who are distracted by horny teenagers, and that's why they all die. But a lot of time, the blockbuster movies of the year or of all time are not really challenging.
You can make an unchallenging film without insulting people's intelligence.
And Cameron is capable of that, because even though the stories in these other movies, as I mentioned, are better than the screenplays aren't bad in any of them. Not Howl or Layden first draft material. That's what this movie almost seems like it was. Okay, I'll jot this down, this 3 hours and 20 minutes, and then I'll go back and I'll fix this and improve on it. It's like they just took the first draft with all the dialogue and said, good enough.
Yeah. Maybe corny dialogue like that, you don't notice it so much when you're watching an action movie. So when you're watching Aliens or True Lies, yeah, of course it's going to have corny dialogue. It's an action movie. It's supposed to be kind of corny. But if you have a romance, then you do want people to sound like human beings when they speak out loud.
And maybe they wouldn't be a poetic since they are so young. Rose is supposed to be 17, Cal is 30, so actually we're not too far from being statutory rape material right there, but Jack is 20, so the combined age of our two main characters is 37 years old. They're not going to be the best at expressing themselves, maybe.
The movie is not coy about Rose's wasted potential. Even at 17, she's always the smartest person in the room, just held back by sexism and the stuffy confines of the upper class. But then that is undercut by scene after scene later in the film of Jack taking charge, telling her what to do while she follows him without protest. And he's always somehow right, down to knowing things that he has no business knowing about, like what direction to go when they're lost in the bowels of the ship, or the physics of what will happen when the boat finally sinks underwater.
Yeah, we know because it got explained to us earlier on, but how does he know that?
How would he know? He probably doesn't even have a high school education.
He's been on many boat sinkings. He's been around a few times.
He was educated on the streets. He was educated in the University of Life. But something I like about Rose's character is that she actually does feel very much like a proper teenager. Her complete immersion in romance. That is like how a teenager would behave. That actually feels believable.
And somebody cares about her.
Yeah, because she's like, nobody loves me, I'm trapped, I have no control of my life. It's all very teen angsty.
Even if Jack had just been a girl or a platonic friend or something rather than a romance, that might have been enough for her to say, I want to be with this guy now. And it's just a friend way if it has to be.
If he had met her, maybe the romance would have been between him and Fabrizio because they had some serious romance going on there.
Yeah, she does sort of horn in and ruin it for him. He takes Fabrizio to the bow of the ship before he even takes her there.
That's true. Fabrizio,
and that's where I'm the King of the World comes from, too.
He was like, Mamma mia.
You're standing behind me. You should always be there, Jack.
Jack, I thought that you loved me.
Well, apart from Cameron's desire to film the actual Titanic, the reason for this movie to exist is the sinking of the boat. And in that hour plus, there's some pretty effective stuff in there, including a nice little callback to the spit take when Jack teaches Rose how to hawk loogies and she uses that to distract Cal. I remember years ago in gym class, we had some guy come in talking about self-defense. At one point he said, if you're being out-bodied by somebody who's pinned you down, has you up against a wall and you can't get away physically, spit in their face because it'll be a great distraction. But the boat going down is effective drama. You said already that he's a great action director and he proved it yet again. Although, Jack does explain to Rose when they first meet that if she hits that water, the pain of it will be way worse than anything else. And then when they end up in the water, they seem cold, but there's not that much of a reaction considering they should be just...
But they should be that way when the water's coming in the ship. They spend a great deal of time underwater, at least up to their waist or up to their neck in water when they're running around the bowels of the boat, when she gets him out of his handcuffs, and they're fine. But then it took minutes for people to die when the ship actually sunk and they were out there in the Atlantic. The water was no warmer in the boat than it was outside the boat.
She reacts when she first goes into the water to go find him. The way you might into a cold bath. But you're right, she never seems to be bothered by that again. If it had just lapped over their feet enough, it would have been, oh my god, what is that?
And they would have already been halfway to hypothermic by the time they wound up in the Atlantic if they weren't already hypothermic and dead. So the idea that Rose outlasts everybody else out there because she's half floating on the door or whatever it is.
And there's only room for one on that door.
Oh. He tries so hard. He never gives up in any other point in the film. He's always the guy that just keeps trying and trying until he succeeds. Until that moment, they try once, he's like, whoops! And then he says, okay, I'll just die here in the Atlantic.
That's been mocked by many people in this movie. We probably shouldn't harp on that too much because it's the Hitchcock answer. If he gets onto that door, then he survives, and where does your movie go? Then you can't have your 101-year-old Rose reminiscing about a guy that lived. Oh, it didn't work out so well after all, actually, so we didn't stay together anyway.
I believe Rose would have had a happy life in poverty with Jack, about as much as I believe that Jack never slept with that peg-leg prostitute back in Paris.
I don't agree with that. The way they present Rose, she would have been more than happy to be with this guy. If she had to be poor, then so be it. At least she was with somebody who cared about her. In movie language, that's enough. I'm not saying it's enough, but in movie lingo, if he'd lived, they would have been happy for the rest of their lives. We got through Fargo last week, well, 2 weeks ago, as we took a week off, and we said Norma and Marge could be happy together. I mean, not poverty, they're doing okay, she's a police chief, but they're by no means rich. So why is it any different with these two?
Because Rose is not Marge Gunderson.
Maybe she could be.
She's a spoiled rich kid who compares the Titanic to a slave ship.
That's a bad line.
Yes!
That was a very bad line, James. You did not think ahead there, old Jim. Ugh. Well, Rose does have a selfish survival on that board thing. Then she's really selfish by ditching the necklace at the end.
Ah, the necklace! Why?
She kept it all those years, never cashed it in. I guess the idea being, I'm not going to benefit off of Cal's money. But then why'd you keep it all those years? And then what is it supposed to signify, Jack? They have nothing in common whatsoever. In fact, they're the complete opposites. It's an inanimate object, for one thing, and it's also this incredibly wealthy inanimate object. And he wasn't that at all, and he didn't live as long as that stupid necklace did.
It might have been appropriate if the necklace had been some sort of MacGuffin in the 1912 story, if the necklace itself had been the object that motivated people to do awful things instead of entitlement and romantic jealousy. Then throwing it overboard and ridding the world of such a symbol of greed would be appropriate. But instead, the necklace represents the burden of wealth, which Rose had already relieved herself of 85 years ago. So why make this symbolic gesture now? If she had thrown the necklace in the ocean in 1912, mm-hmm. like when she's on the rescue ship, that would have been far more appropriate than at the very end. As everybody points it out, maybe your sweet granddaughter would like this necklace?
Well, it looks like the Cowards have had a pretty good life. They're not wealthy, but they're doing all right. But yeah, they might have had a little less problems with bills and that kind of thing if she just cashed this stupid thing in at some point. Well, you say it's the MacGuffin. It is for the modern storyline, which we agree takes way too long to begin with. And then at the end, I don't believe these boat pirates can be moved by that story. I never really got Titanic until right now. They're also going to sit there and listen to this stupid story. It has nothing to do with the necklace almost ever. And be wrapped up in it that much. Then again, look how many audiences were by the movie itself. But you have to put yourself in their shoes. That all they want to do is find that necklace. And now they're talking to somebody who maybe knows about it. And they got to listen to her ramble on about this guy.
Know,
that has nothing to do with
enough
it.
Enough about Fabrizio. Get to the necklace.
Somehow you know that Guggenheim died. I don't know how you know that. That's too bad, but I want the necklace.
How would you know these details?
There's all kinds of talk about how this movie makes men cry. I admit it, Dance with Wolves has made me tear up at the end. When Wind in His Hair is saying to Dance with Wolves, stay with us, don't go! And Field of Dreams knocks me out, both Kevin Costner movies. And the Toy Story movies have done that, and many other movies have too. You talked about the old couple making you misty. I appreciate that moment, didn't make me misty. What makes men cry in this movie? I don't get it. I get that women would, because women tend to cry easier at movies other than me, I guess. But I don't really get what the thing is with this. Maybe because Jack sacrifices himself for Rose and then just freezes to death and dies in the water, like almost everyone else who went into the water.
And as characters go, Jack is actually harder to believe as a realistic character. Rose feels real, but Jack just seems like a teenage girl's fantasy more than an actual person that any guy is going to relate to and want to be or feel for at the end. And I don't know a single guy has ever admitted to crying to this movie. Crying to Toy Story 3, yeah.
According to the internet, though, a lot of guys do. Also, one more thing we said about the necklace not being an important device in the Cal, Jack, Rose thing. Well, that is why Cal pulls the gun. I said it's then came the wolves kind of moment, but that's why he's doing that. It's, yeah, I'm going to get back at you for taking my woman, but it's also, she's got the necklace, and I want that too. So if there is some motivation, it just isn't enough motivation, considering the circumstances.
Cal's such an inconsistent character, because he really is evil and seems to care about nothing but himself, but then he does also seem to care about Rose when it's convenient.
And like I said, I thought when he first meets Jack, and then when they first have dinner with Jack, there are enough scenes where Billy Zane played it as if he's not just a jerk. Yes, he's leaning that way. If you've ever seen a movie before about love triangles, he has to go that way. I do love the review that somebody wrote about Gangs of New York. Billy Zane must be mad that Daniel Day-Lewis is getting all this press for playing an Oscar-nominated character when he had the same character in Titanic and Leo's in both movies too, for that matter. They could have shaded him a little bit more, just like the mother. Wouldn't have taken too much to make them a little more human. And I thought they were just on the verge of it with Cal and then managed to make it so he's just not what he could have been, which is a person with motivations. Or motivations that are consistent and do make sense. And he was in Back to the Future. That was his debut. We did that not long ago for the Not 100 Project. But he never did find stardom. This is the biggest movie he was ever in. Then again, that's true of all of these people, I guess. But his rival in the movie, Leo DiCaprio, is one of the biggest stars in the world. And he's got a movie called The Revenant that comes out in December. So only a few weeks away from when this podcast drops. It looks interesting. Looks violent and bloody. Tom Hardy's in it too. Directed by Alejandro González Iñárritu, who just won the Oscar for Birdman. Or won three Oscars, actually, for that movie. And the emo Kate Winslet, her only AFI film is this one. Although we did do Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind from the Not 100 Project. Much different character than this one, and only 7 years later. She was already a good actress when she did Titanic. She got so much better as the years went on. She's done unending good work, actually. And she and Leo reunited in Revolutionary Road, where they play a married couple. It's almost as if these two did have some kind of life together and made money. They weren't super rich, but were pretty well off. Now, it could have gone badly.
It's like the polar opposite of Titanic, because it's an incredibly deep, subtle, dramatic, cynical film about marriage, about relationships. There's nothing romantic about it. And I loved it. I like Sam Mendes.
Her actual husband, Sam Mendes, did direct. And there are some sex scenes in that. I always kind of wonder how that works when a director's got to direct his own wife.
They're not married anymore.
Well, they were at the time.
Yeah.
This whole cast, DiCaprio and Winslet and Zane, Francis Fisher, Kathy Bates, it's whiter than snow in Greenland around here.
Well, there probably was the case on the Titanic.
That would have been true. That's true, very true. That's actually true about Saving Private Ryan, next week's film, too. You don't have very many, if anybody, who isn't white in that film. And most of the cast of The Lord of the Rings, our last Top 100 Project film, is also pretty lily white. We were covering movies in the 90s that had diverse characters. Pulp Fiction has plenty of black characters in it, and it isn't really an issue. They just are black. Do the Right Thing is all about race relations, and you got people of all types in that. But you're right, Titanic and Saving Private Ryan, they are being accurate to their period. Soldiers would have been white, and people on this rich boat would have been white. The Captain Bernard Hill, he's in the Lord of the Rings movies, but not in Fellowship of the Rings, so we won't get to talk about him, but I loved him as Theoden in Two Towers and Return of the King. Robert De Niro could have been Captain Smith, and that would have reunited him with Leo, who he'd worked with twice before, in Marvin's Room and
This Boy's Life.
This Boy's Life, right. And that would have given De Niro six AFI movies rather than just five. As far as the other actors, David Warner, who's been working for 50-plus years and has that great death scene in The Omen where he gets his head cut off, and he is Cal's bodyguard and also suffers a pretty terrible fate. The boat cracks and he goes down into there and falls or gets impaled on something. Gloria Stewart, who does play Old Rose, she was in The Invisible Man in 1933. That made no movies between 1946 and 1982.
Wow.
She lived to be actually 100 in reality, although she wasn't 100 when she made this movie.
Didn't she get nominated for an Oscar?
Best Supporting Actress.
Oh my god, because she's terrible.
Interesting trivia about that, though. Kate Winslet was nominated for Best Lead Actress. They play the same character. That's happened twice before, ever. where two actors play the same character in the same movie and were both nominated for it in lead and supporting categories. Winslet was involved in both of them. The other one was Iris, where Judi Dench plays the older version of her.
Huh.
And that was only 4 years later, too.
That's a good trivia.
Yeah, it is. Bill Paxton is the chief writer. You mentioned Aliens. We've talked about it a few times, actually. A lot of people have said his performance in that is great, and a lot of people have said his performance in that is terrible because he is whiny and over the top. He could be a good actor. A Simple Plan is a great performance the year after this, in fact, he did with Sam Raimi. He's not that good in this movie, and I didn't buy his whole thing about, I never really got Titanic until you told me this story about the boyfriend you had who died after you met him a few days later. He's worked with James Cameron a lot, and he'd been in Apollo 13, where he is actually quite good, a couple years before Titanic, and I guess the best thing he's known for is Big Love on TV.
Mm. His best contribution to his parts of the film are just that he brings charisma. But he's doing the best he can with this terrible, dumb character and these awful lines that he has to say.
And he does seem to fit better in the modern scenes, so if Cameron was going to use his longtime friend, who he pretty much always did, I guess that made the most sense to put him in those scenes. Susie Amos, who's also in the modern scene, she is Rose's granddaughter, hasn't made a lot of movies because she became Mrs. Cameron in 2000, and she's made nothing since 1999. And she just lets him do his boat expeditions and say he's going to make Avatar 2, 3, 4, and 12.
Yeah, she stopped acting when she married her director, kind of like Kate Capshaw.
Capshaw did work, though. I looked that up. Capshaw worked not a ton after Spielberg and she got married, but a little bit. But Amos, just nothing at all. And Jim Cameron, that tyrant director who's made hit after hit after hit. His two most popular movies at the box office are, I think, his two worst, the last two he's made, Titanic and Avatar, both because they're kind of stupid. But after all the successes he'd made, especially with Aliens and Terminator 2, it must have been all of his clout that he didn't get an R for all the swears and then Kate Winslet's wonderful naked body for us all to enjoy. Really, if you think about it, this movie should have gotten an R. Next week's movie, Saving Private Ryan, is a hard R. This one should have probably been the same. And also, the horrible deaths on the boat.
Yeah.
All those pinwheeling bodies. People always talk about that one when it hits the propeller and spins. It's a horrifying moment. You don't see any blood, and the guy's so far away that you wouldn't really get to see it
anyway.
There's
some disturbing scenes. He does it so well when you see the frozen bodies, and they're swinging the spotlight over them, and you get a good look at all those corpses. It's a rather disturbing scene that stayed in my mind for a long time afterwards.
They were in a tank in Mexico for something like 6 months, I think it was, in total, because, of course, this movie took so long to shoot. And that's where they shot, though. So there's actually some production footage of Cameron, the technical people, the cameraman, in the water, about up to maybe their waist, but maybe even their knees, and all these people have to look like they're actually
floating
in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
And they were covered in makeup to make them look frozen.
Probably for weeks on end. Cameron was also the writer and a producer and an editor, so here's two straight movies after Fargo with the Coen brothers, where the director wears four hats. Cameron, in fact, has written all eight of his non-documentary movies, and I'm sure he's going to write all the Avatar sequels or whatever else he makes before he gives it up. He's not exactly young anymore, so he better start making those sequels if he ever wants to. And it's a shame, because I was not a big fan of Avatar to begin with. I only ever saw it once in the theater. It was impressive, much like Titanic was supposed to be, although I didn't see that on the big screen. But he's capable of more interesting films, like the Terminator movies especially, although that series has run into the ground and then some. I wish he would get off of this whole thing. Then maybe you're onto something. Maybe he did what Lucas did in the 70s. When Lucas made THX 1138, an esoteric, pretty smart movie, nobody went to see it. American Graffiti was a big hit. Didn't really have a structure per se. The movie worked very well, and a fairly smart screenplay. But then he deliberately dumbed things down, or at least made it for kids with Star Wars, and made the biggest hit of all time for many years. Cameron's only made one movie since this one where he dumbed it down. Maybe he took the Lucas mold and made more money because of it.
Maybe there's just a certain kind of genius to making a real crowd pleaser. I will never understand why people like the Transformers movies, but God, they love them.
But they don't
or
have
Twilight.
A talented man. But Transformers and Twilight, maybe some of the Twilight movies have some talented directors, but the Transformers movies do not have a talented director at the helm. Michael Bay has made one movie I've liked. Okay, maybe two. The Rock and Armageddon. And even those are terrible. I just enjoy them.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. They're terrible, but at least you enjoy them. And I feel that way about Armageddon and The Rock. I've never loved, even though everybody else does. I have watched the Twilight movies out of some weird masochism. They are just terrible, but they cleaned up.
I think I heard somewhere years ago that Michael Bay looks up to James Cameron as his role model. Mm. And Ed Harris, who worked with both of them, Harris on The Abyss, where he was torturing all his underwater scenes, and Harris worked with Bay on The Rock, and he's on the commentary saying something about how, why do you want to pattern yourself after that guy? He's an a-hole.
But so was Michael Bay. And Cameron is a real notorious a-hole, and the tales of how he treated everybody on the set of Titanic became real news fodder for all the time they were shooting it.
That's been true for him before, though. When he made Aliens, he struggled with that English crew big time. They didn't respect him at all. But then, as people have pointed out, he knows everyone's job as well as or better than they do. So that's a big part of it. He's got credibility to say, you're not shooting that right. You're not lighting that right. You're not doing that effect right, whatever it might be. He'd probably do all of it by himself if he could. If you could make a movie literally by yourself, if you could afford to take that long to do it, he probably would.
He's almost like an engineer as much as he is a filmmaker, because he spent so much time and attention on the models, on the mechanism that the ship was going to tilt, and the special effects that were still fairly new at the time, and they look pretty good.
Yeah.
They stand up all these years later when I know that there's better stuff. He doesn't leave anything in the final cut that doesn't look convincing unless you're looking really closely. And he's a control freak. Obviously a serious megalomaniac at times when he's on set. He's like an army guy. And he has a lot of people to manage, and he's not trying to make friends.
I understand that. I would rather hear stories about how the production was difficult. We're not supposed to know these things, and how is it any of our business when we watch the movie? We're not supposed to watch Titanic and think, I bet Cameron was rough on the actor in that shot, and that scene was probably hell on her. Sorry, people, I don't really care. I mean, I do because I'm interested in this kind of stuff, and I've learned thousands of hours worth of material from documentaries and commentaries, so I know I'm being hypocritical in saying it that way. But when you watch the movie, you're supposed to just do that for 2.5 hours, or 3 hours and 20 minutes in the case of Titanic, and that's supposed to be what you focus on. Who cares if the shark didn't work properly for days, or they had typhoons and Apocalypse Now, or if the Wizard of Oz stuff happens? You're supposed to watch the movie. So if Cameron's tough on his people, that's not my problem.
I get the impression that Judd Apatow runs a really fun set, and everybody who works on his movies just love going to work, and they joke around with each other, and they just have such a great time. They're good and people like them, but they're just all over the place. They're always way too long and rambling and kind of lose focus. So there's something to be said for having a sergeant who's in charge and who acts like a boss.
When you have the budgets that Cameron's had for most of his career, you're going to have to be more of a sergeant, because you're going to have to marshal all these people together every single day and keep them focused on the task at hand.
I think that it made people want him to fail. There was probably a lot of people in Hollywood that were disappointed that the movie did as well as it did. And that's part of the reason why people gave him such a hard time about that "I'm the king of the world" speech in the Oscars, which just seemed like a cute and appropriate thing
to say. He was quoting his own movie.
People's reactions to Oscar speeches sometimes are such a mystery to me, where they'll think one thing is just adorable and wonderful and the coolest thing ever, and then something else they'll just leap on somebody and think it's dumb and inappropriate. And that was one where they gave him such a hard time about that. But I think it's just that Hollywood doesn't like James Cameron.
Well, because a lot of them have worked with the guy, undoubtedly, and they don't like the way he works. So he's a jerk, so he deserves it. And also, I mentioned Apocalypse Now more than once in this podcast. There's no doubt people wanted Coppola to fail. And he still didn't, because that movie did succeed. Coppola's failures came later. Cameron still hasn't had a bomb. He's only made one movie since this, as we said. But even his documentaries have done okay by documentary standards. They haven't been able to rub it in Cameron's face yet, and maybe they never will, because if he just makes Avatar sequels and retires, they're going to do fine, if not great, again, because people want to see that all over again. They'll never get a chance to say, "Yeah, look at you, failure!"
Yeah, they'll never get to enjoy the Schadenfreude.
Okay, so the 2.35:1 movie, which was actually a 70mm print, and one thing about the prints, some theaters ran them so often that they had to get new ones sent because they just wore out.
Oh my god.
And this is the first time in a long time we watched a movie on Netflix.
It was a better print than our old DVD copy.
Oh, way better. It might have been the Blu-ray they put on Netflix, but it looked pretty good.
Sorry, your old DVD copy that you came into the marriage with, because I never spent money on this movie.
I won't be watching it again anytime soon, don't worry. The cinematographer, Russell Carpenter, he replaced Caleb Deschanel, who's the great cinematographer on The Natural and then later The Passion of the Christ. Carpenter shot True Lies for Cameron before this and then later wanted to do Ant-Man. The editors were Cameron himself, Conrad Buff, who had hands in E.T., Raiders, and Terminator 2, not as a main editor for the E.T. and Raiders movies, but he was involved in those, and Richard A. Harris, not the Irish actor, that's why the A is in there, and he was one of the editors on T2. The music, I'm sure not one of your favorite scores, but James Horner, who is terrific. He did the music in Aliens, Field of Dreams, Braveheart, and of course Avatar. I may have mentioned this before. If you've never seen the Aliens documentary, it's a good time to bring it up on a James Cameron movie. The producer, Gail Ann Hurd, Cameron's ex-wife, points out there's a music cue in that that's been used in probably hundreds of movie trailers now. And I thought, what's she talking about? Then they go to the scene in Aliens where Ripley's about to get rid of the alien at the very end of the movie, and it's...
Yeah,
that's from that movie. I don't know why I didn't know that.
Oh, wow.
So James Horner's written one of the most used pieces of trailer music of all time.
It's like the Wilhelm scream of musical hits.
Yeah. But what did you think of the music score? Because you notoriously have hated the ones we've had on this list. We like Carter Burwell with Fargo. That was weird and quirky. This is more Hollywood grandiose.
The thing I hate about over-the-top movie scores is that they spell everything out for you, and that's the fault with everything in this movie, so...
Well, speaking of music, and Horner had a hand in this too, the song...
Oh, yeah, we have to talk about the song.
The song that was everywhere for a long time.
Yes.
Celine Dion, My Heart Will Go On.
I'll say this, we are Canadian. That woman is a national treasure. My Heart Will Go On, maybe because it got overplayed so bad. It's not even in my top five Celine Dion songs, people. But I like it. I have a little affection for it still.
Well, the woman can belt. I'm never going to deny that. I haven't heard that song in a long time, and it was fine to hear it over the end credits. I always hate, though, when an Oscar goes to a song in a movie that no one ever heard because they were already leaving. Maybe with Titanic they were weeping for another 10 minutes. I don't know. But when you're already in the parking lot and the song's playing, it doesn't deserve to win awards.
James Cameron did not want any songs with lyrics in the film and had kiboshed any suggestions that they write a song. So James Horner wrote this song in secret with Will Jennings and then waited until Cameron was in a good mood and presented the song to him and suggested that they play it over the credits. And he was like, okay. And he went with it, and then the song, on top of everything else, was a massive hit. He knew it would make the studios happy, because there's nothing like a great radio hit to help promote a film.
And speaking of Horner and Cameron, after Aliens, which was not a fruitful production for their relationship, they didn't work together for a long time, and then they came back together to do this, and then they did do Avatar as well, so obviously they made up. And that's enough about the music. So the influence. You mentioned prior versions of Story. There have been two that I counted. The 1953 Titanic, and A Night to Remember, which is also in the 50s. I saw them both, don't remember them all that well, but I'm sure they were more subtle than this one was.
They had less gun chases.
Probably did. Yeah. Leo became a ginormous movie star, and still is. He doesn't really do small films anymore, and that's a pretty big influence when an actor who was liked becomes one of the bigger stars in the world, and for all these years later, nearly 20 years, he still is. He also takes chances. That Revenant movie we talked about, that's not an obvious blockbuster. Maybe it will fail for all we know, but he goes out there, risks his life. I heard literally he and Tom Hardy were in danger at times.
And he's been Martin Scorsese's muse for quite some time now.
Leo equals Tom Hanks, the movie we're going to cover next week in Saving Private Ryan, because, ooh, spoiler alert for Saving Private Ryan. But in their dying moments, they inspire someone to just live, baby. There's a movie called The Ballad of Jack and Rose, which has nothing to do with either one of these two characters, but I want to say that because I get to say Jack and Rose again. But one of the influences that didn't come out of this movie, no Titanic 2.
I bet the studio wanted to.
Dredge it up and sink it again. All right, this is a long list of awards and AFI recognitions, so here we go. Titanic won 11 Oscars. It's one of three movies that did. Do you know the other two?
Gone with the Wind?
No. We've covered one as an AFI film a long time ago, and one we won't cover because it's not an AFI film.
Was it English Patient?
No. Ben-Hur and Lord of the Rings, Return of the King.
Oh, Lord of the Rings.
They all won 11. So Titanic won Best Picture over L.A. Confidential and others. Best Director for Cameron. Best Editing, Cameron and his friends. The Cinematography by Carpenter. The Sets, that's an appropriate one. The Costume's also pretty appropriate. The Sound Effects, the Visual Effects, that song, and the Music Score by Horner. Three failed nominations were Winslet for Best Actress, Gloria Stewart for Supporting Actress, and the Makeup. Leo wasn't nominated and was not at the show either. People at the time were scandalized by that. How can he not be there to support everybody? I don't know if he was protesting, but he probably had the opinion, if I'm not nominated, I'm not going to go. And he did lay low after this. He made that movie with Woody Allen called Celebrity, where he's just one of the many people in that ensemble. And then he made The Beach, which was just awful. But he didn't make any movies for a little while there, deliberately or not.
He really didn't want to be a pretty boy. The character wanted to give him a tick or a limp or something, and Cameron was like, no, you're just going to play this straight. He is one of those actors that likes to shake things up and doesn't want to be a boring Hollywood handsome guy.
And has taken on some pretty tough characters to play in the Scorsese movies, for one thing. He still gets to look good, but he isn't relying on his looks either.
Which is just fine, because he didn't really age that well. He's still fine looking, but he never was cuter than he was in Titanic, that's for sure.
Those worry lines came in fast.
Yes.
So Titanic is not being preserved in the National Film Registry. That's not that shocking, although most movies we've covered have been preserved there. All right, the AFI list. So, number 100 on the top 100 quotes with, I'm the king of the world. The movie was 37th on the top 100 passions, 25th on the top 100 thrills. My Heart Will Go On was 14th on the top 100 songs, 14th.
Wow.
Man. And Titanic was 6th in the epic category of the top 100 genres. Is it really an epic? Unless I'm on one boat, I guess the scope of it. All right, fine. And the two fail nominations for Jack as a top 50 hero. Hero, huh? And the top 25 music scores. I'm going to summarize by saying this. I would never put this on my top 100. It wouldn't even be close. I liked it less watching it with you, although we had so much fun mocking it for that 3.5 hours. But according to the AFI's criteria, this is an easy one. Do the Right Thing, we both thought, should have made that list and then some, and it barely did the second time around and didn't the first time around. It doesn't even have the credentials apart from being just a really good movie, because it didn't make a lot of money, it didn't win a lot of awards, didn't make other AFI lists. Titanic covers all that and then some. So it belongs there for those reasons. It had to be there for those reasons. But I'm not actually a fan of it, even though we own it.
Well, I'm going to raise a glass and drink to the fact that I never have to watch this movie ever again. I'm happy to defend the things about it that are good, like the special effects and the action scenes, but you can't take a sirloin steak, cover it in ketchup, and call it a gourmet meal. And to be honest, I don't think that metaphor is altogether fair to ketchup. And to all the diehard fans of Titanic, you deserve better than this. And just because it was successful, so was Twilight.
Well, as for that ketchup steak thing, my nose is in the air. That is just not good enough for a man of my breeding. All right, enough about Titanic. Up next on the Top 100 Project is Steven Spielberg's sixth and final AFI picture, the Herring War flick, Saving Private Ryan. And now we're in an era where movies that couldn't have been on the first list are only on the second list because they came out after the first list had been released to the public.
Movies have to age before people are ready to say that they were great.
So the coming attractions trivia for Saving Private Ryan. Who had more films nominated for the 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists? Tom Hanks or Steven Spielberg?
Oh, that'll be fun. Okay. So for the answer to that question, please tune into next week's podcast. And in the meantime, if you'd like more trivia from Ryan and me, along with all kinds of other fun stuff, including links to some of the things that we talked about in today's podcast, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project in iTunes. And you can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. Ryan and I are both on Twitter. You can find me at BevEllisEllis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. But if you would like to message us privately, we love to hear from you guys. Send us an email. Our address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And before we go, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Bye, Bev.
Bye, Ryan.
Bye, Bev.
Bye, Ryan. Ryan,
Bev.
Bye.
Bev.
Ryan.
Bev.
Ryan.
Ryan. Bev, you're so Ryan. Stupid, Bev. You're so stupid.
Oh, Ryan.
You're so stupid.
And cut.